Thank you for that. I appreciate the effort to move forward. We are a small group, and we want to take the opportunity today to have some dialogue with you, and that will be easier to do if you all are a little bit closer and closer together. My name is Jennifer McKeever. I work for an organization called the National Network of Public Health Institute. We are a nonprofit organization based in Washington, D.C. and New Orleans. And we have 44 member public health institutes across the country. We also serve late 2014, we serve as the National Coordinating Center for Public Health Training, and it is that work that we're here to talk to you about today. I'm going to allow my colleague to go ahead and introduce themselves rather than reading you their bios, and then we'll go ahead and get started.
Feel free to just yell.
I think I will. Hopefully you can all hear me. Hi, everyone. I'm Christina Welter. I'm the Associate Director of the Doctorate in Public Health Leadership here in Chicago at the University of Illinois School of Public Health at Chicago. I am also one of the principal investigators for the Regional Public Health Training Centers for Region 5, which is here again in this region in the Midwest. So excited to see you all this morning.
Morning, everyone. I'm Vinny LaPaza. I'm the CEO of NMPHI, but I really work for Jennifer, and I'm glad to be here with everyone. I still believe that workforce is sexy, so next year when we come, we're going to pack the train.
Okay, so none of us have any relationships to disclose. All right, so a little bit about what we want to do in our hour and a half today. First of all, Dr. LaFranca is going to talk about the needs of the public health workforce from his perspective. And then I'm going to share with you a little bit about, I mentioned the National Coordinating Center for Public Health Training and the Regional Public Health Training Center Network, which is our approach to addressing these public health needs for workforce training. We're then going to hear from Dr. Christina Welter, who's going to share about her work with the Region 5 Training Center, which is based here in Chicago. And then finally, we're going to have some discussion and input. The work that we are engaged in here is building on a long history. The Regional Public Health Training Center program actually began in 1999, but it was reconceived in 2014 into a new model. And so while we're building on a rich history and rich experience from all the training centers, we actually have an opportunity to do something new and to make some real progress in training. And so in order to do that, we would love your input. But first I want to start with a little quote. Have you all heard this quote before from Yogi Berra? We're lost, but we're making good time. Does it feel like that sometimes in public health? I know it does for me. So before we get into talking about how we hope to get unlost in the work that we do, we want to take a moment and ask you a question. And that question is, what is the biggest challenge you face in your work today? Or if you're coming in as a manager, supervisor, or leader, what is the biggest challenge that the workforce you work with faces today? And so I'm going to ask you all to just have a conversation in groups of two or three, if you will. Introduce yourselves to each other and then share what is the biggest challenge you face in your work today. We'll take about 3 minutes to do that, and then we'll have a discussion. All right, if we can come back together. We'd love to hear about some of those challenges that you all have been discussing. And so I'm wondering if there is a volunteer from our group that wouldn't mind introducing themselves and sharing about the challenge that your group discussed. I recognize names. I'm not afraid to call on people, so. Yeah, hi.
Good morning, Valerie. Virginia here. I was actually sharing some time from when I worked at a state health department and what the experience was like, and the thing we talked about was just not having enough time. So time constraints either with new activities or with ongoing activities in the workplace, and on top of grant writing and other management tasks, to the big issue.
Great, thank you. Any other volunteers?
My name is Magali Angeloni, and I work for the Rhode Island Department of Health. And so I do workforce development for the department. And one of my challenges is that I want to, my challenge in my previous year that I come up with, I can share. I feel that people should be able to access more training, but there are so many competing priorities, people don't have time. So I figured that maybe what I could do is that my leadership to approve that every person in the staff should be able to have like around, say, 5 hours only for workforce development issues within the month. So 5 hours a month, maybe you can say that, I don't know. But the problem is that if you're approving that, will probably lead to, abusing some certain part of some of the individuals. And then I also want to know what they are doing, are they reading, are they, attending a webinar or whatever. So I want to be able to track it in train. So that's my crazy idea. It's a long shot, so I am wondering if anyone else has a family that has some idea.
Great, thank you, and good to see you. Marita.
I'm Marita Roman, the Director of Solution 2 Public Health Training Center, and my colleague here is from NAMCO, NATO, and my other colleague here is from University of Massachusetts at Lowell, so we get three very different perspectives. NATO colleague who's talking about the biggest challenge on a day-to-day basis is balancing expectations and needs from the membership and considering to get funders. My other colleague from a program of public health is talking about the challenge of identifying leadership within the program. And I would say, much like you were saying, the challenge of trying to get leadership in health departments to inclusively identify a way that individual workers can participate in training, whether it's the existence of face-to-face. There's a lot of talk on each side, we need training, they need training, and so identify how that can happen.
Great, thank you. Gianfranco.
That's right, he's old as well, so you should ask him.
Jim.
Hi, my name is Gianfranco. And what we talked about was sort of the missing link around the operational success, efficiency, and effectiveness between the basic science of public health and how we actually function in agencies. And so we think that there's lots of work going on. The people need to talk to each other, junior staff working horizontally, mentoring each other, and with mentors around the skills that are going to be important to them in the future about changing the system and moving the needle.
Mm-hmm.
In the short term.
Yep. Thank you, Gianfranco. Yes.
I'm Dan McCormick with ETR Associates. I think the biggest challenge for us, and it's perpetual, is aligning today's people, processes, systems, and money to serve the immediate needs, but trying to find a pathway to tomorrow's requirements is very challenging in the current funding environment.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Great. Thank you. Okay, well, for those of you that didn't share your challenge, I'm sure it's in your mind, and what I'm going to ask you to do is hold on to that, because later on in the session, we're going to ask you to help us determine how we can help you meet that challenge through training and workforce development. And now I would like to turn it over to Dr. Vincent LaFranca to share some reflections on the needs and challenges of the workforce.
Thanks, Jennifer. I think APHA, the opening session, sort of framed some of our challenges really well, and Dan, you did as well. One of the challenges that I think all of us have in the workforce space, and in particular people working on developing curriculum, how do you develop curriculum in a timely way that is relevant at and also integrates the changes in practice? And so when I think back to the early 90s, we thought about workforce development as sort of capacity development models. We used to write all these grants and cooperative agreements to develop capacity. And there were lots of different ways that we used those models for training. They weren't necessarily formal coursework. A lot of them were built into our program development. Today, I think this is what the workforce is really faced with. And for those of you in the capacity development world, it's overwhelming. There's so much out there. There's so many reports and publications and opportunities. And even just looking through the wonderful programs that APHA offers, you know, there's lots and lots of silos. But at the same time, we know there's these macro forces that all of us in the practice field are dealing with. You know, unfortunately, in this country, the Affordable Care Act, I think, sort of fed some of this politicalization of all things health and healthcare. I'm hoping we're turning a corner on that. I know in the DC, sort of the Beltway environment, there seems to be a little bit more positive sort of spin on health now. But it's been a very rough period, I think, for all of the workforce in general. And we still have an unbalanced emphasis when we look at all of the life expectancy data around the world. In the U.S., we're still very market-based, and so if we don't, you know, there's this push for more and more evidence, and anything we do should be evidence-driven and you know, cost savings. But we know that we've got to make some better investments in all of the determinants of health if we're really going to turn that corner. I think these are all challenges for curriculum developers as well. Our congressional approach to solving problem still is very siloed, the way we fund our programs. And again, how do you, when you're building the capacity of a workforce, how do you address those capacities across all of the different siloed programs? I think there's a lot of positive pieces that are coming out of the Affordable Care Act, for sure. And at NMPHI, we're doing a lot of work in the bridging spaces, bridging public health and health care, figuring out you know, from the clinic to the community, how all of those things could work to improve health. I think these are also challenges for public health workforce development and training. We have a lot of staff in public health that aren't really familiar with that whole world, and then the clinical world is not necessarily familiar with the public health world and the frameworks that we use and the definitions that we use. Population health is a good one. It means different things to different folks. We for sure want more evidence on what is actually working, and I'm hoping that in the next few years we can have some good conversations with all of the folks in the training space in terms of what are those training and learning experiences that do have some evidence, and how do we hold them up, how do we lift them up for the workforce. And you know, assuring the conditions in which people can be healthy remains the mission that we all believe in. But we know we can never drop the hard work of preparing for infectious disease outbreaks. But at the same time, the biggest drivers are still really around our chronic disease efforts. How do we create health? How do we build health into everything we do in the society? This is the whole sort of health and all policies movement. These are very, very difficult challenges that we have. I was at a breakfast this morning that APHA offered talking about collective impact models, and there's a lot of testing going on around that. And again, how do we deal with that for the workforce development? And obviously intense competition in the field. There's intense competition for scarce resources. So all of these sort of macro factors, I think, have determined sort of or presented the workforce developers and the trainers with huge challenges, but also opportunities for us to think about the evolution of what the practice needs. And so information technology explosion, demographic shifts, I mentioned politics, of course, but I think there is an increasing realization that health is a production of society, and these are all very important factors. It's where the Arbor Johnson Foundation comes with their culture of health initiative. And if you look around the world, if you look at other countries, there's lots of conversations about you know, how people are creating health. And so I think these are also opportunities for how we go about our developing strategies with all the regional public health training centers. It's quite a delivery system. And so as you develop curriculum, there's needs assessment processes, which you'll hear more about from my colleagues, and so those should be also driving how we do that. And I think the whole sort of demographic shift is affecting our own workforce. Oftentimes we think about what the workforce is doing for the population, but we also have to pay attention to our own workforce within our organizations. Some of the cross-cutting work going on by many of you in this room, I know the De Beaumont Foundation, the CDC, there's Robert Wood Johnson, other foundations, there's a lot of work going on around the drivers that we should be paying attention to for the workforce. Change management is a really hard skill to teach, but I think there's a lot of good coursework that we could be developing. There's some coursework out there, we just need to understand more about it. Innovation in systems thinking, because if we're going to really create the conditions in a society for health, it has to be beyond your individual area. I mean, my background in environmental health was very, very siloed in my training in terms of, how do you reduce exposure in a Superfund site, as an example. At that time, 30 years ago, we weren't talking about, conditions of health and creating, backbone organizations. It was a very sort of siloed approach. It was good in the sense that we had some, good material, good knowledge, but in terms of what you would actually have to do in practice, it could be very different. And I think the whole sort of millennials and more diverse populations in the United States, we need to understand that better. We need to think about, for those of us over 50, sort of how do younger people learn? How do they acquire information, and then how do they use and apply that information? It may be very different than the way we were used to learning. Fiscal strategy is also very important. Years ago you wanted to work in an area, you wrote a grant, you got the money, you did the work. It's all very different today. We are asking an awful lot of the people that are responsible for training, and the budgets are shrinking, as we know, and so I think this is we need more innovation in that. We still can't excuse the fact that we've got to make those investments, but we for sure need some more innovation in that fiscal strategy. And how do you teach the workforce about that? And then, of course, the whole strategic policy discussion about what's the role of policy in improving population health, and how do we build that into all of our coursework and all of our learning experiences. We also have been doing some surveys around learners' needs. This particular survey, I think it was about 843 respondents from around the country, say these are the things that are important to me as a learner. Obviously, the relevance to my work, cost, this is how I sort of make decisions about whether I will participate in training, ease of access, and obviously availability. And then this, what I thought was very interesting is access to advanced topics. So the learners really do want to be challenged. They want curriculum and learning experiences that are going to challenge them. These are only the top. We have a lot more data that we'll be sharing over time. That was a pretty robust survey, and I'd love to even expand that survey. But again, this is just learners telling us what they think is important to them. And so we do know that we are charged by CDC and by HRSA to redefine what this delivery system looks like. And so you will hear a lot from us in terms of opportunities to participate in that and in influencing that, how we work across the 10 training centers, how we make these programs more accessible to everyone. And so it's a tall order. We're in it for the fight, and we will for sure do what we can to make a delivery system much more accessible. And I know the work, I'm very, very impressed with the work that's going on in all the 10 regional centers, and you're going to hear more about the local performance sites as well. So thank you.
So let me ask you all another question. How many of you, could I just see by a show of hands, are familiar with public health training centers and the work that they do? Okay, so a little more than half. at least. So what I'm going to do is just take a minute to tell you about the training centers and a new model for the training center work, and then we're going to hear an example of the training center here in Region 5. So HRSA, the Health Resources and Services Administration, has funded public health training centers since 1999. And historically, they have operated fairly independently with some voluntary coordination among the centers. And at one point, there were about 36 training centers that were based in universities, primarily within schools of public health. And in 2014, HRSA released a request for proposals to reconceive of this public health training center model. And what they did was release one request for proposals for 10 regional public health training centers, and one proposal for a national coordinating center to help coordinate the work of those 10 regional training centers. So we are a network now of 39 local performance sites or local affiliates that are associated with 10 regional public health training centers. And we are, I've got animation in here that I am a little unskilled at using, so forgive me. And so we are working together since the fall of 2014 to transform public health training in the U.S. We're committed to serving as the go-to resource for high-quality training tools and resources so that we can not only make good time, but also know where we're going, to go back to that Yogi Berra quote. So let me talk to you just a little bit about the network. And I also want to acknowledge that there are a number of folks in the room that have been a part of the regional public health training centers and previously the public health training centers for many years. So don't feel shy to raise your hand and jump in and let me know if there's anything that I don't reflect accurately. But currently, the 10 regional public health training centers are university-based, and they are located within accredited schools of public health. I mentioned those 39 local affiliates or local performance sites, and many of those are also university-based in schools of public health, but there's also a variety of agencies that are participating in developing that training. Those include some public health institutes. There is a State Association of County and City Health Officials, or a SACHO. There is a School of Dentistry, and some other nonprofit organizations or community-based organizations that are helping to shape training within those regions. The training center network reaches all 50 states, Puerto Rico, and the U.S. Virgin Islands, as well as the U.S. territories, and is responsible for developing training and supporting the workforce, both the current and the future public health workforce. So I want to take a minute to just focus on that. When we talk about the current workforce, the training centers are based in universities, but they are responsible for providing training to those who are currently working in public health. The primary audience is those working in governmental public health, and the secondary audience is everybody else working in public health. We know that the majority of folks who are in public health today are not actually degreed with Masters of Public Health or Bachelors of Public Health. And so it is the training center's mission to reach out and ensure that those governmental public health employees and other public health employees have the training and resources they need to serve the communities that they serve. In terms of the future public health workforce, I think this has two prongs. The first of which is because the training centers are based in schools of public health, they are responsible for building the future workforce among the students that they are teaching and training and providing field placement to. But I also think when we talk about the future public health workforce, we're thinking about what are the future needs of the current public health workforce going to be? What are those skills and capacities that we are going to need to ensure that we're meeting the needs of the community in the future? And I think we're hearing what some of those are with a lot of cross-cutting skills that are needing to be developed. And so it's the responsibility of this training center network to make sure that there is training that is ready to go to meet the needs of the future public health workforce. This program is written into legislation, and it has four key prongs. The first two, I think, focus on that future public health workforce and include that the training center should establish or strengthen field placements for students. So each of the 10 regional public health training centers is responsible for placing students, is it 20 students per year? Yes, 20 students per year in a field placement site, as well as facilitating faculty and student collaborative projects. They're required to designate a geographic area to be served, and that fourth one is a single bullet, but it's really two very large charges, I think. The first of which is to assess the health personnel needs of the area that they are serving, as well as developing the training to meet those needs. So overall, the Regional Public Health Training Center Network and the National Coordinating Center endeavor to ensure that there is high quality training available to the workforce. And so I want to pull that out for just a minute. Many of you may know that there is a lot of public health training that is available online and that you can access. But it's not quite as easy to determine which of those trainings are of quality. So how do I, as a public health manager, know which courses I should send my staff to or require my staff to take and as part of their workforce development? Which courses should I take as part of my workforce development? Sussing out what that quality is a bit more difficult and something that this Regional Public Health Training Center Network is committed to help clarify in the years that we're working together. We also want to build skills using innovative learning technologies. So one thing I haven't mentioned yet is that HRSA, the Health Resources and Services Administration, has placed a focus on distance-based education. And so developing online distance-based resources for the public health workforce. And a number of the training centers are engaging in innovative activities to do this with developing videos. The training center in Colorado is currently about to release 17 trainings on cancer. There'll be 10-minute videos that they're going to release. A lot of other training centers are looking at how do we make training available on mobile phones and other resources such as that. And I think Christina will talk with us about what they're doing here in Region 5. And then lastly, assessing the nationwide needs for public health training so that we can make sure that the training that we develop is meeting the needs of the workforce. We're also working to prevent duplication in course offerings. So I talked to you again, there's a lot of training out there. If you did a search for Public Health 101, you're likely to find a lot of different trainings. So we're looking to reduce the duplication of the trainings that are being developed across the network. We're looking to coordinate student field placements. And so I mentioned that each of the training centers has 20 student field placements for each year that they have to complete. And we're looking at how can we coordinate that on a national level to increase the opportunities that are available to students and increase the placements that are available to them. And then also lead training responses to emerging public health issues. So one other piece I want to share with you as I pull up the training centers themselves so you can know who the regional public health training centers are. Another aspect of this program that HRSA developed is that each of the 10 regional public health training centers has a content area or a specialized focus area. So you can see here, those include public health preparedness, health disparities, health informatics and information technology, infectious disease, environmental public health. Behavioral health, diabetes, cancer, nutrition, physical activity and obesity, violence and injury prevention. Now, if you're like me, you probably look at these and think each one of these is a kingdom unto itself and could have hundreds and hundreds of trainings available. And so we are working with the training centers to identify what are the quality courses within each of these content areas. There's one thing I want to clarify because it's been a point of confusion, and that is that the purpose of these content areas is so that the full network has expertise hubs for training in these areas. It does not mean that that is the only area in which the training centers are developing training. They are also assessing the needs of the region that they serve and developing training to meet those needs. And in addition, they will have expertise areas which are identified here. A couple of accomplishments so that you can see the reach of the network. Now, the data I'm about to show you is from 2013-2014, which is actually prior to the network forming with the 10 regional public health training centers. And so this is the accumulation of the 36 public health training centers when they were operating independently, not as a network. They delivered more than 2,200 continuing education courses to 249,900 trainees, and 29,000 of those learners were working in medically underserved areas. They partnered with more than 1,300 different public health organizations at more than 750 sites, about 40% of which were located in a medically underserved community. They coordinated field placements for 925 graduate students of public health nationwide, of which 167 came from financially and or educationally disadvantaged background, and 145 of those are considered unrepresented minorities in their public health profession. And finally, they supported over 230 faculty-student collaboration projects which addressed emerging public health issues in local communities, which included 490 faculty members and 1,600 students. All right, so let's hear an example from Dr. Christina Welter of the Region 5 Public Health Training Center.
They're a little taller than I am, so just give me a minute here. Right. Good morning, everybody. I'm pleased to be here as a part of the network and this presentation, but I also think workforce development is sexy and exciting, and is really an opportunity for public health to create change. And so what I want to talk to you about today, and I just want to emphasize, we are one case, if you will, we're one of 10, and so our approach is going to be somewhat similar, but yet somewhat different from the other sites around the country. And I think that's great, because there are incubators, if you will, then across the country handling innovation in different ways. So just keep that in mind. I'm also pleased to announce that Sophie Nagy, who is our coordinator, each of the 10 sites has a coordinator and then a principal investigator, a halftime evaluator, and an instructional designer. So Sophie's right here, and I just want to make sure everyone acknowledges her, that she's the bedrock of our project. So, and there might be some other folks from Region 5 in the room as well that I didn't get a chance to see. So the story that I want to tell really is around these strategic questions. And I heard some of you say this, say kind of hint at some of these in your own challenges. But how do you go beyond the grant requirements? How do you address the tension of what is a pretty rigorous, strict grant mandate with 75% reduction in funding from what these PHDCs used to have, and still create change and do something with these limited dollars? And then added to the complexity, as Jennifer already alluded to, there were 36 different public health training centers, and this is now boiled down to 10. So there's a lot of stiff competition. There was a lot of tension in terms of what do we do with smaller amounts of money that has to be spread across the same population base. So these were the two questions that in Region 5, and just to you saw the map, but to say it out loud, we're a huge geographic region. It's Minnesota, Michigan, Wisconsin, Ohio, Illinois, and Indiana. Did I get them all? that's a large, large geographic region. Illinois alone has 8 million people, so you can get a sense of the number of people we're talking about here. So our belief, though, here in Region 5, and I do think we are a little unique across the nation because we have a collaborative approach that I'll share in a minute. Our mantra was that when spiders unite, they can tie up a lion. So our region here, the Region 5, as I said, there were 36 different sites. And so rather than competing, which many of the other 10 regions or 9 regions ended up having to do, we chose a collaborative approach. And so even before the RFP or FOA was released, There were leadership efforts on behalf of Ohio State University and Michigan and others to come together. There were conference calls before the grant was even released to collaborate, that we acknowledged that there were 47 years of experience with these public health training centers, and rather than compete against each other, we wanted to see how we could leverage. And so this is sort of the breaking down the silos piece of this, which is easier said than done, but it was something that we stuck to and we've worked very hard for. We were chosen at the University of Illinois Chicago as a central office, and we see ourselves as a facilitated leader. And I really think that's an important concept in all of this work as we try to break down these silos, because that requires humility and us to really have to, you know, collaborate and to look for common strategy across these six sites, much less the nation, the six sites within each of the states. Each of the states had a very strong public health training center previously. And so my story here today is to talk about a little bit of that collaboration, because I do think it's so important if we're going to talk about a vision of workforce development. When you have thousands of trainings, we're going to have to collaborate. There's just no way that we can boil those down in a way practice can understand without that collaboration, with the very little money that we all have for workforce development. So the other mantra for us was, in addition to this concept of, you know, when spiders unite, they can tie up a lion, is that we have already been doing this for so long that, as Jennifer said, there are literally thousands and thousands of trainings. Well, what's a training? We haven't really talked about what training is and how you might define it. And our region really looked at it more as building capacity, that we didn't necessarily want to see a 30-minute module or a self-paced course that was 6 modules long. We didn't want to do it the way we had always done it before. I have to tell you, I used to be the deputy director of the Cook County Department of Public Health, so I'm a practitioner at heart. I came to academia 3 years ago, and I can say that it's overwhelming in numbers of information pieces that we get on whether it's a report, an evaluation, trainings that are available, conferences, you name it. It's hard to sort through all that. So we didn't want to do it the old way. And this was a collective belief among all of our six states. The other is that we needed a vision. We needed to have something, as some of you have already alluded to, you need to take action, but without some kind of vision, you're just kind of a gerbil spinning in its wheel. So that was another thing that we really thought was important. The new training, or what we would prefer to call building capacity approach or workforce development approach, alongside a vision. And so I actually stole this from Vinny. I don't know if he recognizes this, from his very first PowerPoint that he did a year ago, and I really liked it. As we approached our strategic thinking for this grant as a region, we had to acknowledge, as Vinny already shared, the tremendous change that we're going through and undertaking in public health, whether it's at the local public health department level, whether it's in the community, whether it's ACA implementation. I mean, this is monumental change, so much so that we can't even get our heads around it. And so we're really struggling to try and sort through all that information and decide what's the best focus when you're applying for a grant like this. And so emerged out of that, and this came from some of the conversations we had had in the field with our practitioners and our partners, was this that exact tension of ACA implementation, that population health clinically and population health defined in the local health department was very different. And so that became something that bubbled up in our region as something we wanted to address. So this is a picture of our website where you can see the theme of population health on top. And so our theme became capacity building for population health improvement. And which I'll explain in a little bit, is actually getting integrated now into our assigned topical theme of environmental health. And we chose a collaborative approach, kind of a one-stop shop. So this is our website where if you're interested in population health, you can click on that particular link. If you're interested in environmental health, you can click on that particular link. And our goal here is to sort of hit this sweet spot of managing the mandates on one hand, and I'll explain that in a minute, but at the same time, I'm going to share a bit of some of the strategic approaches that we're taking to address population health in a more of an innovative way. So we're trying to kind of do both. We're meeting these grant mandates, but at the same time moving beyond what's required or what's scripted. So our original application, and this is hard to read, but I think just simply put, what's unique is that the circles, those 7 yellow circles or 8 yellow circles, are the mandates that we're required to do. But our vision here was to address health equity and to drive population health improvement. That wasn't required in the grant. That wasn't something that was a strategic theme that wasn't asked for. It's something that as a six-state region, we wanted to figure out. We didn't have any answers. We just knew there was a disconnect between what was happening on the ground about how to do that work collaboratively. And we also knew those kind of green, yellow squares that we needed a structure, that you need some structure for the conversations to take place. And so that's what those represent. And I think that's really important because you have to have a vision and you have to have a place or a structure for these things to occur, for the discussions to occur. So how are we organized? And again, I think it's important because you're thinking, oh, this is a grant, we just have to implement the grant. Well, we saw it as beyond that. We wanted to make sure there was a place for the conversations of strategy to take place. So we formed a leadership committee of the six PIs of our COIs of each, and that's the language used in the grant, of the co-investigators, across each of the states. That is not typical. That usually the central site is the parent, if you will, and the LPSs underneath are the sub-grantees. While it is true that the six universities are sub-grantees in our case, it is much more of a flat organizational model. So we're collaborating in all of the six, sit on a leadership committee, and we met weekly in the beginning to set up our, what did it really mean to implement our vision? What was it that we wanted to see? Not at the end of the first year. It wasn't about one-time training. It was about in 4 years, what is it that we wanted to see? We created an implementation committee where the program folks were able to talk about how the work would get done, and then an evaluation and needs assessment committee. We also had a regional advisory committee, which isn't atypical, but it was a representative from two practice individuals from each of the states. No more. There's one additional person from the Great Lakes Coalition, which is the Public Health Association coalition in the region. And the important thing just to mention here that's also a little abnormal is that the regional advisory committee vision here was to push and pull information. So this idea that there are all these trainings, there's all this information that I talked about as a practitioner that I was overwhelmed by, is the vision, is that the what we call the RAC, we would be sending information to those practitioners and they are the liaisons to the rest of their state. So like here in Illinois, the vision is we have two public health institutes, we have our Mid-America Center for Public Health Practice, the Illinois Public Health Association, and there are many others I could name, but there are at least four or five alone doing workforce development. That doesn't make sense, at least to not coordinate. I'm not saying take away their autonomy, but that each state should be coordinating what's coming down on behalf of the national center to the region and then to the local and back up and down, a push-pull model. So it's the structural elements of this that add to the implementation and create action beyond just the vision. So that's why I want to emphasize that it's important. The structure is important beyond just the vision. We develop charters. These are also important because collaboratives fall apart when expectations don't come through. So we have charters for each of these groups. The website is a one-stop shop, honestly not for the public. That website right now is not necessarily the best place. We're expecting people to go to their local state sites, not necessarily our site, because again, who needs yet another website? But it is there as a home for us, as a coordinating place. And then Sophie sends weekly emails to our partners, to those leadership committees, and then those ideally go back out to the public health community in each of the states. And in the charter development, and I just have to say we spent all fall, last fall, developing this. That's how serious we were taking this as a group. What would it look like in 4 years, to be successful? What were our operating principles? If someone starts to back out, if one of the other PIs, one of the states starts to not participate, what do we do about that? What do they want us to do if they start to back out? Because by the way, the funding was equally distributed. Our central site doesn't take any additional money. We only take the base for our staffing. So it's equal distribution across the six states of the funding. Well, how do we make decisions? Is there a chairperson, and how do we report and communicate? And these are hard to read, but I just want to pull a few of these out because I think they speak to this regional model that can be developed, I think, even more across the nation. Number three, for example, that a system of coordination and communication for workforce development will exist. So again, instead of having hundreds of emails going across, could we get to a place where there are a few, maybe not just one, but a few, so that as a practitioner, I'm not sifting through all of those emails. We also really wanted to see the benefits of what I think the vision was for regionalization, that we were preventing duplication of efforts, we were leveraging our resources where possible, and really actually driving innovation. And then really we do believe, and we are trying, they think this takes a lot longer and has more resources than we have, but that we really want to see systems change. And we still have that belief in mind, and I'll share what we're doing around that in a minute. So to get started, you know, here you get this grant money and you think, oh, boom, we can go. We can just do these webinars. We can do the courses. And again, that's not our mantra. So we did an environmental scan. How many of you have heard of an environmental scan? Good. So a good number of you. So it's really a kind of looking out across the nation, not just our region, as to what already existed for population health improvement. So we looked at what trainings we had in our particular region. We looked actually also outside nationally, and indeed there are thousands of trainings. We looked at the published and peer-reviewed literature for what was out there already for population health improvement and capacity building also. And then we interviewed national and regional partners about what they thought were the gaps and trends and definitions of population health and opportunities. And the results of these probably won't surprise most of you in the room, but this process, while it took a little while, proved really useful for us because now we have a framework for 4 years. Every time we write our continuation grant, or should we have to write a new grant, we have a vision already in mind based on the work that we did here that's operational. So I won't read all of these for you, but a couple of key things here that because there are thousands of trainings online already, what do you do about that? You can't just get rid of all of them. So one finding or opportunity out of that finding, since there are thousands of trainings for population health, is could we organize those trainings in a more meaningful way? Not just review quality. I think a quality review is really important. But again, part of the struggle as a practitioner is I don't want just one course. I want a whole skill set. So can you organize these trainings around a skill set that's going to drive change in some way? Can you package them better and differently? So that's one thing that we're actually doing and are trying to do in our region. The other big thing that we heard is engagement, that there is not enough engagement in workforce development, that these webinars and the self-paced courses are great, but we need some other modality online since that's our requirement for engagement. This is kind of a new and up-and-coming conversation, I think, in public health. And when I say engagement, you know, we're known at UIC for doing distance-based education, so I'm not talking about the games you can play to engage in a course. I'm talking about systems change in the field. How do you actually organize a process, not just in a one-time course, but a process over a period of time where you can see policy change, where you can see environmental change, where you can see systems change with the group of people? And so that was the second thing that we really hung our hats on. And the third thing that we really hung our hats on was leadership, that the funding for leadership programs across public health and, quite frankly, workforce development is minimal to none. There are very few opportunities anymore. In fact, MidAmerica's our own leadership program is on hiatus right now because of, I think you heard yesterday, our state, you know, we don't have a budget here in Illinois, nor can anyone afford to send their health department leadership to a leadership training program. So there's a gap. There's a huge gap for leadership development and, quite frankly, leading change. So we developed this conceptual framework, and this, it's not perfect, but it drives our work for the next 4 years. And the goal is very lofty, and I have to be honest, I'm not sure we're going to get there, but it is a vision that we will see as a result of our work increased multi-sectoral integrated action toward population health improvement across the spectrum of care. That clinical care and primary prevention will be working together in a way that addresses interventions across the spectrum of care, and they'll be working in communities of practice. So take that backwards into what that means for programming, and we have three pieces. We proposed a leading change institute that would either be entirely online or a hybrid model. The second thing we proposed was a population health improvement center, and I'll explain that in a minute, and then these communities of practice. And I have to emphasize, this is visionary. We've been taking baby steps. It's the best we can do with the situation we're in, but we're excited about the beginning. So one thing we did, this Population Health Improvement Center, we started because by the time all this came out, it was about in May of this last year. So we didn't have the time to build out a center the way we might want. But what we had heard was that there are a lot of activities nationally going on and even state-based for population health improvement and raising the awareness of what that looks like for clinical care and primary prevention, but not much is being done at the local level. My colleagues in the local health department are really struggling for information about how do they adapt. So what we're doing right now is we have domains on the left-hand side for population health, and each of the six states, rather than duplicating, fit their training into one of those domains. And so we're, this concept of sort of trying to sequence the trainings in a package, is this was our first stab at it. We're going to try it again this year with some tighter kind of theoretical elements to it, but you'll be able to click on any of those and get a sense of what trainings are available. And then for environmental health, you're probably wondering, what did you do about environmental health? Because of the time that we had, same concept, we just prevented duplication by making sure everything we did around environmental health was relevant and timely and not duplicated. So we ended up with three programming elements around that. I'll show you in a minute. So this was an example of a flyer that we have, and I think we're distributing this tomorrow, of what each state did around population health improvement and what we're trying to strive for, to kind of create more of a package. And hopefully this gets conceptually tighter throughout the years. So it's kind of the old model of training, of doing a webinar or doing a course, but it's hanging together in a different way. That it's not new, but it's not common. The thing that we're most excited about is what we're calling our Population Health Inquiry Project, and this is using an action learning approach. How many of you know action learning? Small handful of you. So the idea, and this is especially difficult in a distance-based format, but it's the idea that if you are working with a local group of people to take their experience but apply theory or training or workforce development and reflect on their learning back in the field and then cycle through projects and initiatives and problems that they're facing, that they'll learn better, they'll learn faster. It's an adult learning theory. So you're taking your strengths, you're taking your own problems, and you're then taking in new information, reflecting on that, and addressing it, applying it in practice. So through this, we have conducted a large regional needs assessment / inquiry project, because the first stage was really what are the problems in the field. And we conducted 11 virtual conversations in each of the six states with primary care providers and governmental public health agencies, and we got 100 participants. This isn't research. This is a needs assessment, and it's the first stage of an action learning project. So this is really tricky to kind of do that dance between research and application. We are just now summarizing, with the questions being, how do you define population health? What strengths do you have around population health? What gaps do you have? What training needs or development needs do you have around population health? And our next stage now, we've collected all of that, we're analyzing it, is to present that back both to our team here in the Region 5, but then it's going back to the RAC, the Regional Advisory Committee, and it's going back out to each of the six states and asking them, now what do you want to do? What's next for you now that we're presenting this information to you? With the goal of then having a multi-year plan of how we can help advance population health improvement in each of those states. And then I already mentioned for environmental health, this is trickier. In the year to come, we're actually trying to merge inquiry and environmental health. But climate change, we actually found thousands of courses in environmental health. It's huge, as Jennifer already said. It's a kingdom, I think was the word you used. So we interviewed AFSTO, NACHO, NEHA, and there just wasn't an easy way to kind of cut across all of those. So what we heard is that climate change is really important, so we did a session on climate change. We also did one on informatics and environmental health in Michigan, and then the One Health approach in Ohio. So these are all cutting edge topics, at least, and they're not duplicating anything that already exists that we're aware of. And last but not least, what are we doing next? So as I already alluded to, we're expanding this population health center concept to make it even stronger, more robust. We're aware of multiple efforts around the nation, so we're hoping to collaborate with some folks that are already doing some similar elements to this. We want to build on what we found from the inquiry project and create sort of a three-year plan out of that. And then we're taking environmental health and we're going to go back into the field and do distance-based conversations with local health department folks on environmental health and how they define it, how they perceive it, and what do they need. So rather than going back to the thousands of trainings in environmental health, we're going to go down to say, what change can we create with you at the local level, and how can we make a system shift for you that has some kind of national implication? And last but not least, you know, I'm standing here representing our entire region, and I, again, this is a facilitated leadership collaborative model. So I'm really just the messenger here, and we really believe that leadership and learning are indispensable, that it takes leadership to do this kind of collaboration with this timeline, with this amount of resources. So thank you for the opportunity to share our story.
Thank you. So we want to take this opportunity, we actually have about 30 minutes left, to talk with you and to get your input. But before we do that, let's pause and see if you have any questions for us on what we've shared so far. Yes. And would you mind introducing yourself when you ask your question, please?
Yes, but I'll preface something. I'm sorry, I just want to know what's another session. So this has been directed by people who apologize. I'm Rosemary Chelman. I'm from Ohio. I'm the editor of the State Department. And I'm intrigued by the slides where you're having, trying to have conversations with the local health. Mm-hmm. We're trying, we finalize our environmental health section in our affiliate. And one area that we do on health is trying to convey to sanitarians of the state health department. We need to not neglect focus on water and food and other parts, but to start thinking more environmental health.
Yeah.
And so I wonder what, if any, implication of you prefacing your work as environmental health, talking about health talks about environmental health, and not saying environmental health. And again, if you're just sorting out, I'm sorry. I think the term means a lot to start to shift to environmental health.
Yeah, I'll stand if you can see me. What you just said is exactly something that we're hoping to see emerge, which is that there's probably our, hypothesis isn't the right word, but what we're thinking is that local public health departments see themselves narrowly as people who do inspections of food, water, air quality, and so forth, not more broadly what I think you're trying to say is environmental public health. There is no reason why I didn't say public health, short of that we were assigned environmental health. So what you're saying is, yeah, we are looking at what are the perceptions of environmental public health in local health departments, and should there be an opportunity to shift the image and the thinking around what they can do to be more strategic, even.
And the thing I would add is, I think, in some cities, I think a lot of the lack of focus on environmental public health is the lack of direction and support that.
If you don't mind afterwards, please feel free to give me your card, and we can, because we are looking for champions in each of the states to help us with the work. So, yeah.
Yeah, no, I would like to comment on that. I appreciate the question. Right. So this is a great opportunity for the delivery system to make a difference in practice, in the sense that, if I'm a trainer, I might think of my role as just content development and delivery, but if I'm part of this network, I might think of my role as, how do we actually change the conceptualization and the frameworks that are out there? In this country, we've separated environmental health and public health in so many ways. We did that at the state level, and to some degree, in the 70s, when we created EPA, we did that structurally. EPA was not, intentionally not part of the success. So, we're not going to be able to change the federal structure, but from a training and a learning standpoint, this is a network that can do lots of those sort of interstitial pieces. I think it's really a great opportunity to change the way we practice and train people.
Yes.
I have a quick question for you around cost. Is part of your mandate to deliver your training without a direct cost to the person taking the training? I'm speaking from Canada, and we have had to shift from a no direct cost to a cost model for some of our online training, and it's been, what's the word I'm looking for, catastrophic.
Yes, so specifically through the part of this work that is funded through HRSA, yes, the training that is made available is free. We do see this as a starting point for how, the funding that HRSA is providing us as a network as a base, but we see this as a starting point for transforming public health and public health training. And I think that's a question that when we get a little bit further down the road, we're going to have to ask ourselves as well.
Yeah, Yeah, well, I just wanted to add when you said that, because it was never free.
Mm-hmm.
People had to provide the time, employers had to provide time, they had to
sure.
provide the infrastructure, and even the technology in our early days, so it was never free.
Mm-hmm.
But now we have to charge individuals, and that's having a negative impact.
Mm-hmm. Any comments on that from either of you? Okay.
I mean, one thing we're required to do is just a sustainability plan in this country, and I appreciate your comments. My concern when we saw the deliverable was, you know, that sort of a, you know, I mentioned before, we can't let people off the hook for the Congress to say, well, if you have a sustainability plan, you know, we'll give you 4 more years or whatever, but then you're sort of on your own. I think that would be catastrophic in this country as well, just from, you know, the budget that we see in public health.
Yeah.
I will say, though, a lot of the training centers, part of the innovation, for the money that we're giving, that HRSA is providing to you all and to us to do this work, is one piece of it, but all of our organizations are trying to bring in other grants to supplement. You know, so you've got the core infrastructure, but for example, we're getting PDP grants now for developing training. We're putting out RFPs for the training centers as one example. You probably have lots of different funding pots internally, so it's probably a mix.
Define lots. Right.
I just one quick thing to add that's important. I agree, and the workforce development cuts to this country for public health have been drastic. So we're getting, and I know many of the centers do have other ways of fee-for-service, if you will, type models that we're piloting. We're not there yet in Illinois. Mm-hmm. But one thing this grant does ask for beyond sustainability, they don't call it that, but it's systems. Integrating the work into a systems change. And to be fair, I don't think we were doing that very well before. In other words, the grant was the grant of the grant in the university. They didn't work to coordinate or leverage or maximize in the way they should have. So shame on us in that way. You know, now we're forced to do that so that we don't have to move. Yeah.
Yes.
I'm trying to work from Portland, Maine, one of the local implementing sites. I want to ask for your region, how do you balance the trainings that are good for the whole region versus for that particular state? And all states are so different. And I know our partners say, yeah, that's okay, but the examples aren't Maine specific. You know, the way
we
help organize is different in our state. How do you balance all
those
make it actually really
possible? So we talked a lot about that, and Sophie, please chime in if you want to add anything to that. And what we came down to is that population health improvement and the tension between clinical care and primary prevention was so large that no one could argue with it. So in other words, that became a theme, and then each state was given the freedom to say, well, this aspect of that was really important to us. So delivering culturally competent, not care, I forget what Minnesota, with their particular element is, that was what they wanted to do. So that was the chunk they bit off in those domains for population health. So we agreed first on the strategic theme, and then each state decided what was best for them based on their strengths and what their population needs were.
So it wasn't necessarily then Minnesota or
I guess I'll give you my personal perspective. I don't see why not. I don't think there are that drastic of differences in practice that they really won't work. It's about the relationship and making the locals feel as if it is coming from them, which is why we're doing the inquiry piece, right? We're trying to merge sort of the trainings with what people have said so people do feel that it's relevant to their needs. Yes, there are going to be some environmental factors that are going to be different across the country, but the reality is everybody needs leadership skills. No one's going to argue with that. Everybody needs community health improvement skills. So that's sort of how we try to look at what we all needed versus what one state was so different on. I hope that is that a fair summary? Does that make sense?
All right, can we ask you some questions? So we asked you earlier at the beginning of the session to talk about the biggest challenge that you face in public health or that the folks that you're working with are facing. Now knowing a little bit more about who we are and what we do across the country, we'd like to ask you, how do you think that access to quality online training could help you address the biggest challenge that you noted earlier?
Well,
So why don't we go ahead and do this in the groups? Oh, we've got one here. No, nope, we've got two here. Okay, so we'll do this as a large group. Never mind. Go ahead.
Hi, my name is Laura. I'm a health sciences librarian from Oregon Health and Science University in Portland, Oregon. I help support our public health and prevent medicine program. And I just wanted to ask how what you were doing can be very helpful to me is that I spend a couple of years training these people in all of these programs that they have access to, only enough to help them, and then they don't track them, and they don't have access to that. And I would like the training I provide them to actually line up with the resources that they have available to them when they graduate. And so being able to, I mean, I know you guys existed, but being able to know that information fluency skills would be part of what the training would be included, would very much help me know that I can direct my students confidently to these resources. Does that make sense?
Yep. Mm-hmm. Yeah, when they're out in the field, where do they go?
Well, yeah, where do they go? Yep. Because, I mean, they have access to the meds, and they have access to the for the National Library of Medicine, we at least can see the citations, but they can't actually get access to full text. And information fluency involves more than just you know, being able to search on that. It seems like that's another one of those skills like leadership and change management that I think cuts across.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, I'm a little bit tired of this topic.
Thank you.
Go ahead.
So the other idea that I had was that if there is a local university that is part of the public health training center or the region or whatever, if they have online classes already, they have online programs, could they offer like, you know, a number of classes so that people from public health departments could just audit or just, you know, listen to or whatever those classes. So if there is somebody who needs a refresher or just needs to learn from the beginning, like research methods or something like that, would they just attend those classes? I mean, it seems that it's like very easy to be done, but I haven't seen it happen. If there is like a leadership training that, you know, that somebody wants to attend, again, just like not for credit, just to listen and to be part of it and think about what that is all about, then would that be accessible to like people from the public health department? And if there is a fee for like a tour or something, then the fee could probably be worked out, because the desk for the whatever other is like, I don't know, $200 or something like that, that probably the department itself can afford for one or two people at a time. So rather than create another online or another webinar or like a 2 hour whatever, maybe just make it available to people in public health. I thought that was like a pretty easy, you know, in both parts are.
You mean like a course that the university is already offering?
Exactly.
Yeah.
In many parts. It could be leadership, it could be research and methods, it could be community health, it could be some other things that, you know, like somebody from another discipline, you know, somebody who has a different training they want to learn more about.
Yeah, so my understanding, I don't know if any other group down there or any other university would want to speak to this, but there are some conflict of interest issues, I think, in terms of those paying tuition. And I know it sounds, you know, ideal, I would agree with you, but those paying tuition and then others coming in just to get refreshed, I think a great idea, but from what I've understood anyway, that there's some, you know, some conflict in terms of the fact that some students are paying tuition. However, interestingly, we did offer sort of a free policy course over the course of the summer 2 years ago, I think actually through this program, through the old PhDC. It was free, it was, I don't know, a couple weeks, like 8 weeks, 6 weeks. Nobody, I think 300 people.
Many registered,
yeah.
But no one actually went through the course. So there's no payment connected with it, nobody took it. They go on a public health program and one on policy, and
nobody took it.
They
so I think there's more to be looked at, you know, that there's, I think I've heard that request before, but there's some tension about why, because we took that idea and then offered it for free and didn't get a response. I don't know, anyone else want to comment from, yeah?
Christina, I would agree, Mayor Page, that Columbia University is
like tuition. The tuition is expensive. So to be part of a course, you would be taking up, you know, a seat that other, whether it's distance-based or face-to-face, so that certainly would be an issue. The idea I'm thinking about is just to benefit from listening to a course. It's almost like a MOOC, right? The same sort of thing. So those are out there, and I'm not sure, I'm not up on the data, but I'm not sure people who you want to participate in MOOCs are actually participating. My own, I'm thinking would be if there needs to be some incentive, more than just it's free, to get people to participate in complete courses. And these are a great idea, whether that a certificate, but that would have to have meaning. So I'm going off a little, but I agree with what you're saying, that there are challenges on the university side, but also on the practical side, whether even if they are available, people would avail themselves of those simply to learn. I'm not sure.
Yeah.
I just wanted to comment, we have had a similar problem, but almost a flipped problem, in that the NPH programs in Canada ask that we deliver a course that we charge for. We have to charge for it, I mentioned that a couple times. But we have this course, and the NPH programs from several universities approached us and said, can we have your biostatistics course? Because a lot of people coming into NPH don't know from biostatistics, right? And it's just a way to get them all on the same page before they start the 4-credit course. And it worked really well in two universities where a lot of students took the course. They took it for free, and we're charging our learners, so it was a pilot project. And in one university, it crashed and burned. Nobody took it. And I think it was all about the professor saying, you know what, you should really do this. And the place where it crashed and burned was before they got into the program. They were supposed to take it before they started in September. And where it worked was they took it concomitantly with the first courses that they took. So they had some, they had something to hook it onto. They had a professor. They had someone saying, are you doing this course? Because you're supposed to be doing this course. And when it was the other way around, it was just presented to them. Very few people took it up. Very few people took it. But it was a different, it was the same tension flipped, because we have public health practitioners saying, oh, that would be nice, right? They don't have to take the course, but we do. So there's always that, yeah, that problem, the way to figure it out.
Ron?
Hi, Ron Yellow, public health advocate. And I look at the question, and I sort of, my answer is, I don't know. And the reason I say that is one of the things that we do is we develop and operate training. So, you know, we've got 1 million learners. We have 3.5 million course completions. And what we hear from people is certainly courses could be better organized and find it made easier. We hear that, but the biggest thing that we hear is we take a training and we aren't given the opportunity to practice the skills in our organization. So they take a training and they lose it.
Right.
And then what? So I don't know how to deal with that. That's why I said, clearly we need the training, but how do we get to the point where the employers let people actually practice?
And I think, I mean, I think that's what, you know, you were talking about in the term of action learning, which I've heard is sort of just-in-time training, where you're actually getting to practice the skills that you're learning. And I think the other, I don't know, is the biggest challenge that folks noted at the beginning was about time. You know, and so how does online training sort of deal with that issue of helping folks have time, but then actually getting to practice the skill, which for me says, I think it goes beyond just the online training that you're doing then. Hand in the back, and yeah, Christine. Go ahead.
So I'm intrigued by what Ron says, and I'm thinking that knowing about the application of the knowledge of the skill awareness of trying to convey is a huge thing in sustainability. So what you are having people identify or have their supervisor, tell their supervisor before they take a particular course on a particular course in the area, and then having it be a two-part online training, where the first part is you can get the skills and it's sort of didactic. And then you have people think about how they're going to apply it. And then you have a follow-up where you have people to contact you ahead of time and say, these are the challenges I face, and I'd like to see this addressed in the second webinar. And then you have the webinar where you talk about the challenges or the positives that it happens that you were able to do what you were taught and why you weren't able to. So there's some kind of sustainability and follow-up rather than a one-shot.
I think what you're saying and what I was going to say is that not that this hasn't been tried before, but time to revisit it more thoroughly, is that we have to move out of a single sort of approach to training. That there need to be shorter, more frequent trainings. There need to be more engaged training. And there need to be, and my our definition of sort of action learning is not only go out and apply it immediately, it's actually intended for a movement. We really want to see a movement, which is the longer term. That's what no one's talking about. There's no long-term change mentality here, sort of social marketing change. And that we'd like to, all three of those levels need to be addressed, which is, I think, what you're kind of hinting at.
Immediate and intermediate outcomes.
That's right. Yep.
And also to take some pilots so we could do, so people that are trying to implement the grant programs, for example, in our community, putting public practice to work or whatever. There's all these grant programs. If we had training that were, that was developed for, to help people move through those things, they would have the incentive internally, their supervisor or HR department would understand, oh yeah, this isn't extra work, this is part of what you're trying to do. And if they wrote it into their grant, it would even be in advance too. So I mean, we could pilot some of those things. You can't do it with every piece of curriculum, obviously, but I think it could be a really interesting, innovative way around to make it more real. I know NAJOB's tried some of that with the Roots of Health and Equity Corps, you know, where they're tools and then you put together teams of people in the training so that they're all going through it at the same time.
So a couple of quick things. I would like to take a moment to let you know what's next for us. First of all, as you walk out the door, you're going to be handed a flyer about a coffee hour that we are hosting tomorrow, and that will be an opportunity for more interaction. We'll actually have set up roundtables where you can go around and meet the training center in your area and learn more and ask some specific questions. So we hope that you'll join us for that coffee hour tomorrow. We also hope that you'll take a look at the Coordinating Center website, and the information is on the back table. Finally, we have a sign-up sheet for you as you walk out, and if you're interested in learning more and hearing updates from the Regional Public Health Training Center as we continue our work together and evolve over the 4-year period of this grant cycle, which we hope is just the beginning, we'd be happy to share that with you. If you also sign up, we'll share with you the presentation slides, as well as ask you to continue to tell us how we can help meet your needs. So are there any other questions or reflections before we wrap up today? Thank you very much for your time, and we look forward to interacting with you more throughout the conference. Thank you.